Despite the clouds on the horizon, really humans are already incredibly cooperative. We are already capable of astounding deeds of reciprocity and cooperation and generosity.
Hello, Vicki Robin here, host of What Could Possibly Go Right, a project of Post Carbon Institute. We interview cultural scouts, people who see far and serve the common good, and social artists, those creative, imaginative people who see where change can happen and then act. My guest today is Kristen Olson. She is an author and freelance journalist who lives in Portland, Oregon. Her books and essays range wide, but all seem to explore themes of surprising relationships that knit nature and human lives together. In a transactional world of competing interests, she sees how we are here for one another. In her latest book, Sweet in Tooth and Claw, she tells stories of mutualism, how plants and animals weave together to create life everywhere on the planet. When I was writing my own book, Blessing the Hands That Feed Us, about local food systems, her prior book, Soil Will Save Us, was a big inspiration. Kristen has published articles in the New York Times, Orion, Discover, Gourmet, and Oprah, and many other print and online publications. Her magazine work has been anthologized in Best American Science Writing. Olson says she grew up in a small agricultural town in California's Sacramento Valley, and her parents didn't worry if she was bored or lonely. So when she wasn't in school, she would spend hours in a nearby vacant lot riddled with anthills, watching ants hustle back and forth and occasionally inserting herself in their lives with a spoonful of sugar or sticks to block their paths. She's pretty sure this is where her interest in both science and nature began. And now my conversation with Kristen. Hello, Kristen, and welcome to What Could Possibly Go Right. Our premise is simple. The dark clouds on the horizon are as menacing as any civilization has faced. The media engenders hysteria, but journalists like you dig for the stories of creativity, adaptation, and the new forms emerging mostly out of sight. There's a Chinese proverb that says, a crisis is an opportunity riding a dangerous wind. Guests like you help us squint through the entangled problems to see the opportunities. There is so much in your recent book, Sweet in Tooth and Claw, about mutuality and reciprocity in the natural world. So here's what I want to know. I want to know what lessons we can learn. Years ago, an Indigenous educator put up a slide of a meadow at the edge of a forest. She then said, "These are our elder brothers. We are the youngest species to walk the earth." At that moment, I could not fathom that the grass was my elder. So would you explore with me the lessons we humans can learn from forests and coral reefs and meadows? What social and cultural patterns do you see emerging that mimic in some way the wisdom of the meadow? For example, you told a story of ranchers, environmentalists, and government, normally enemies foraging an alliance. There are lessons there for all of us in communities trying to reverse the harm, save what we can, and heal our landscapes, even with vicious polarization. Is it that stories will save the world, that we need to hear about where opportunities are growing in the cracks of the sidewalk of civilization? So that's what's up for me. In other words, in the midst of all that is going awry, what could possibly go right?
One of the things that I like to talk about is that despite the clouds on the horizon, that really humans are already incredibly cooperative. We are already capable of astounding deeds of reciprocity and cooperation and generosity. You know, I live in a city. I don't know if you live in a city, but I live in a city, and I live in a city with a lot of problems, Portland, Oregon. And I think it's sort of a habit for all of us to talk about how terrible everything is, how broken down everything is, how broken down human relationships are and associations are. But I think that we always have to remind ourselves that that cities, that human societies are marvels of cooperation. You know, and one of my favorite things to remind people of is, you know, when a movie is playing, when you're in a movie and it's in a city and you hear the sound of a siren, and that is an indication that in movie speak, that's an indication that something terrible is happening or something terrible is about to happen. And I always think, no, that means something good is happening. That means help is on the way. That means people have set up systems to help each other when there's trouble. So I do think that we have to step off the panic perch about the way we view ourselves and our world to begin with, and stop looking at it as, you know, everything is broken down, everything is falling apart, because there are so many ways in which we are cooperating and helping each other, and trying to cooperate with the rest of nature. And we'll miss that. We will miss that if we only have this image of breakdown and despair in our head. So that's one thing I would always like to push out there into the foreground. And I think, you know, I think so much of what is happening now, so much of what is changing now, and I guess I'm part of that trend. I mean, I never thought of it when I was going into it, but there, you know, our journalism is kind of broken. And I shouldn't say that because I just finished saying that we shouldn't say everything is broken, but I think our journalism has some problems. You know, our journalism is so animated by what is the most alarming headline? What is the most alarming news? What is going to get the most looks that the advertisers will reimburse the media for? And of course, we do need to know the terrible things that are going on in the world, because if we don't know the terrible things going on in the world, then we can't act to fix some of those terrible things. But on the other hand, you know, I think our journalism for years, as long as I've been involved in it, was really skeptical of the idea of reporting on good things. You know, that's kind of like reporting on paint drying, or, you know, that's sort of the soft-headed way of going about looking at the world. And I think one of the really positive trends these days is that there are a lot of people in journalism. There are a lot of people writing books who are looking for the solutions, and looking for positive examples to spread around. So I do see my book as being part of that trend. And, you know, and there are other, I mean, David Byrne, the rock and roller, David Byrne has a news vehicle, an online news vehicle called Reasons to Be Cheerful, where he not only collects stories of solutions going, you know, that people are implementing around the world and good news that's happening around the world, but he also even assigns reporters to go out and find stuff out. So I think there is a trend that is rising that can give us something to hold on to in terms of solutions. And I love, you know, you know, God, I felt so lucky to write this book. You know, I felt so lucky that somebody like Patagonia was interested in having me write this book, because it was a wonderful thing for me to experience talking to not only the scientists who are kind of reversing years and years, decades of a fascination only with conflict and competition in nature, and looking at cooperative relationships among living things. So that was very exciting for me to pursue. But then also in the chapter that you talked about, getting to talk to those ranchers and scientists and government agency officials in Eastern Nevada, where they've done something that is remarkable in so many ways. So just to give the backstory on that, the scientists and the people from some of the government agencies in that part of the state were concerned about the degradation of local streams. And the reason that they were really worried about it is that there's a local trout that's indigenous to those creeks. And the you know, they were worried that the creeks were getting too warm and too shallow, and the creeks dried up. You know, it's a very hot part of the country, a very hot, stark part of the country. And the creeks would always dry up in the middle of every summer. And they were afraid that it was just going to be impossible for these trout to continue to survive in these streams. So they went and approached the ranchers in that area. And it's a huge ranching area. And we've all, probably everybody that listens to your podcast has heard about the conflicts among ranchers and government agency officials in the past. Anyway, these people went out to the ranchers and said, look, we want you to try something to improve the creeks. You know, we want you to try grazing your cattle differently. And of course, the ranchers, their first reaction to that was, you know, they don't want people telling them how to do their grazing. They're the ones who are making a living at that. Who are these other people to tell them how to change their grazing? And also, there's a lot of sensitivity on the part of those ranchers. You know, they've been hearing for years how they're the ones, their livelihood is what is ruining the West. And they're, you know, sensitive to these questions. But anyway, they did, you know, they do want to get along with those scientists and those government agency officials. So they did start to try to change the way that they grazed to see if that made any difference for the creeks. And they didn't think it was going to work. They didn't think that the creek, you know, that area had ever been any different. They thought that the creeks had always been shallow and that the creeks always dried up in the middle of every summer. And, you know, that was a constant until they started to do a little research showing that, you know, over a century ago, those creeks had been more vigorous, that it had been a wetter landscape. Anyway, so they did start to change their grazing, and they didn't change it so that the cattle could never go to the creeks, but the cattle could only go to the creeks early in the year, and then they had to stay away from the creeks. And that was a big hassle. It meant that they had to use fencing around the creeks. It meant that they had to keep chasing their cattle out of there and untangling cattle from getting stuck in the fences. But then they were pleased. Everybody was pleased when vegetation started to grow up along these creeks, vegetation that hadn't had a chance to really prosper before. But then the ranchers were alarmed when they saw that beaver then moved into the area and started to cut down that vegetation and started to build dams and all that, because beaver and ranchers have a long, bad relationship. You know, beavers are always messing up their irrigation systems and stuff like that. So there's a long, bad relationship there. But anyway, the scientists and the government agency officials said, well, let's just watch. Let's wait, see what happens. And so they all watched and continued to try to improve the landscape with the grazing. And it was just like this miracle on the landscape where over a number of years, not tremendous numbers of years, but the landscape, you know, because the beavers were building these dams and slowing down the creeks. And so instead of the water rushing through the watershed and out to sea, the water started to spread out on the land, and the vegetation started to spread out on the land. Then the vegetation and the ponds that the beavers were creating and all the, you know, kinks in the rivers that started to come about because of that, it started to change this area into a wetlands instead of a dry, dusty desert. And the actual water table of the land changed. So that was a miracle. But also, because these people, some of the scientists and some of the ranchers, really wanted this cooperative effort among these three groups of people to work, they really put a lot of effort into making sure that they were cooperating with each other, that they were speaking with each other. So they started having meetings, you know, monthly at the beginning and then several times a year later, where they would all sit in this big room together around a big round table or around a bunch of tables that had been turned into a circle, so that there was never somebody who was at the head of the table, that everybody had a voice, everybody everybody's opinion was respected. They even had a social worker there who deals with conflict to help if there was a sticky, angry moment. And as a result, these people now have new relationships and new respect for each other and just a new way of dealing with these questions about how do we work on the land and how do we work with each other that's being exported to other areas because it worked. You know, it's not, you know, not only have the creeks been, the landscape been improved for wildlife, which it certainly has. I mean, not just the beaver and not just the trout, but, you know, all these other birds and amphibians and creatures that are drawn to that area. But the ranchers' lands don't burn the way they did, you know, in the heat of the summer. There's more forage for their cattle. It's just been this incredible win-win for everybody. And, you know, sometimes when I think about that chapter, I actually feel sort of teary. It's just such a great story.
Yes. Yeah, it is a great story. And I'm going to pull out some of the little lessons that I hear. There's also the thing you said in the book that they would start the meeting and everybody would shake everybody else's hand.
Right. Twice they would get up from around this round configuration and have what they call a serpentine greeting. So one person would get up and then it would be kind of like pulling a pearl necklace around the outside. Everybody would go around the circle and shake hands and greet each other. And then they would stop and do it again the other direction so that everybody greeted each other twice before the meeting would even start.
I just experienced, I don't have to do the long story, but some of the indigenous people here created a ceremony around a totem pole. They carved totem poles. I think it was Jewel James, maybe. They carve totem poles and bring them to conflicted areas, you know, as an offering. And very often the conflict will abate anyway. So in this particular ceremony, there wasn't a totem pole, but there were about 50 of us there. And they did that. They had the elders started and they just went around the circle. And it was so moving because I went around the circle and I got to somebody with whom I've had a lot of conflict. And there I was, you know, shaking hands with her. So these rituals, I mean, you can introduce a ritual if people trust you. You can introduce something that seems sort of granola. But I want to pull out one thing. One thing you said is that the scientists asked if they would try something. So they didn't come at them as the bad guys. They came up them like, you know, well, we have a thought here. We have a possibility. And would you be willing to cooperate? That's so rare in the sort of polarization world. And so it's more like an invitation with humility, like, okay, maybe you won't, or maybe this is, you know, we have to wait a bit, or what else do you need to hear from me, or blah, blah, blah. So I think it's sort of courtesy. There's something like manners that we sort of poo-poo them like Victorian era, but there's something like manners. Even in the most conflictual situation, there's something like manners where the personhood of the people you're in conflict with is honored. Right. It looks like you might have something to say.
They weren't entering into this effort, bringing in the point of view as these people are assholes and we need to fix them. It wasn't that at all. And
right. Yeah, we need to create cooperative structures. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I loved is that we don't know what seeds are buried in the ground that have not had the conditions to sprout. It's like, it looks like, you know, dusty right. soil. It looks sort of sandy. You can't, but in the body of the earth, there are so many seeds. And it's, there's a word called serotiny, you know, which is basically seeds that only open and sprout after fire. Right. And so that's what I'm hearing, that you create, you know, we go at problems like sort of like frontally. And if you create, pay attention to creating the right conditions, that can make a difference. And that's sort of behaving like a part of an ecosystem. It's almost like what I'm hearing is that this situation was mimicking the reciprocity and mutuality in an ecosystem where at some level, and we can't like project how that consciousness is happening, at some level, every member of the system understands that it's the mutuality that creates the prosperity of the system. So, like, do you have other stories? I think those are the main things. Also, I just had the picture of what if my county council, instead of sitting on a dais and we sitting in, you know, like with our 2 minutes to talk to them, what if we all sit in a circle around a table? I think it would be transformational. But anyway, so just other reflections. I singled out that story, but, you know, in ecosystems that were degraded and now are flourishing, what kind of interventions happened? You know, what was the relationship between people and the land that changed it?
Well, you know, another ecosystem restoration that I wrote about in the book was on the North River in Oregon when, you know, it sounds like such a simple thing where all these groups finally raised the money and, you know, and did the science, did the figuring out of what the problem was to remove a culvert that had been in place for 60 years. And it, you know, it just sort of doesn't even sound like it could be that big a deal, but somebody, you know, put in this culvert 60 years ago so that a road could go over the top of a creek. And it was just wrong. It was up too high. It was up so high that salmon and lamprey could no longer go up river. And they tried putting in fish ladders, but it still didn't work for the salmon. And it was also sort of situated in a way that the kind of wood and pebbles and just junk that lands in a stream that is actually really helpful for making habitat in the water, it wasn't coming through the culvert and making refreshing habitat for the salmon on the downside. And it really just seems like such a simple thing. Finally, they got the money and the figuring it out what they needed to do, and they replaced this culvert, and it was just a, you know, an incredible change to the ecosystem upstream. You know, the salmon started moving up and reestablishing themselves, not only in the places where they had been before, but even going farther up the creek. And, you know, in that other chapter of the book, but before I get to the culvert part, you know, we learned that one of the main sources of nitrogen, which is an element that, you know, forests really need to be healthy, that one of the great sources of nitrogen in forests, you know, in this part of the country are salmon carcasses. You know, when the salmon move upstream, bears and other predators get out there and they eat a little bit of them, and then they toss their carcasses into the woods, and the fungi that knit all those trees together and, you know, knit those trees together and move water and nutrients and, you know, messages around the forest, they take that nitrogen from the bodies, that nitrogen that the salmon have brought from deep in the ocean. So it's like, you know, the salmon coming into a waterway, it's like a gift to the forest alongside. So then that was able to happen in the forest upstream of that culvert. You know, it's just this wonderful, you know, it's a crescendo of goodness that comes from that one. Seems like such a simple act of replacing a culvert that was mucking things up.
And it took research to understand what was mucking things up.
It took research. And that's, you know, I really love Robin Wall Kimmerer's, all of her articulations about our relationship with the rest of the natural world, you know, and she says many things, but, you know, don't take too much And sometimes science is, you know, sometimes it's science that tells us, that can tell us, it's a good tool for telling us what is taking too much or what's doing the damage. So yeah, we definitely need science in these situations to figure out what's going on.
Right. Where are the barriers? So taking a systems approach, and I think in our human systems to, I mean, it's just such a, you know, mutual battering rams right now, and it's not going to get any better, I don't think, if it just is media fed. But taking time to see where the stuck place is. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I noticed in both of these stories was that groups that may not have any connection with one another on a daily basis, you know, they're not knitted like a forest is knitted. Our ecosystem of nonprofits and of, you know, government agencies are not knitted together. And that, you know, just like a simple knitting of three or four agencies, and together they can raise the sufficient amount of money to actually solve the problem. And a lot of times activists are sort of on the ground, you know, punching our fists, you know, in the air, you know, just demanding change. But it's not doing the knitting of agencies or groups where there's a mutual benefit. And I remember it's like situations. One time I was doing, for a project, I was doing a lot of networking. And there was one organization that wouldn't come to the table because they said, we are the table. You know, okay. So it's that question of the pre-work. I hear the pre-work. And then also the facility, you know, what are the facilitating elements so that, because you can't just bring opposing things together and presume that they're going to just turn out if you make a round table. So, you know, what is the sort of social glue elements of how these things knit? Because I'm sure that, you know, if you went about collecting stories of how communities, you know, in relationship with the natural world, in landscapes, how communities have mimicked, have become part of the ecosystem, you know, have been, you know, it's almost like we become representatives. We could become the voice of the ecosystem rather than. Mm-hmm.
You know, the last chapter of my book is about cities, and I got to meet with, while my leg was broken, I got to fly to France and go to this conference of these amazing activists and visionaries and thinker doers from around the world who are trying to make cities greener and more welcoming to the rest of nature. And of course, then that makes cities more welcoming to humans. So I loved watching that process going on. You know, how can we adjust the way we have buildings and walkways and parks, and how can we do all this so that we are making room for the rest of nature?
Right.
And, you know, so the poster child for that effort around the world, I think, is still Singapore. You know, Singapore, they have policies where if there's a building going in and replacing an ecosystem on the ground, well, they, you know, that there's a lot of pressure, a lot of motivation to replace that, have that ecosystem, have that greenery and those plants and the animals that interact with those plants, have them somewhere else, you know, on top of the building, going up the sides of the building. So it was, and I still marvel over this, that the city, that Singapore has grown, the human population has grown, but at the same time, the green cover has grown. You know, we think of that as being opposing in, you know, directions, that those couldn't possibly happen together. but they are doing that. And, you know, there are so many things that are coming out of that too, you know, that there are, that they're finding more native species in this, in the area, that people who live there are becoming more aware of the native species and can, and know them. Just so many wonderful, wonderful things happening at the same time, this braid of good things happening because they're trying to make Singapore something that welcomes all of nature, not just us.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how a principle that's adopted by government can make a difference. And back, I think in the early 1990s, when I was working on Sustainable Seattle, we were just like starting to like develop indicators of sustainability. And I came across the story of Portland, which is probably not true anymore, but there was a principle said, everybody has the right to see Mount Hood. And it governed the building. People could not build something tall in front of somebody else's view.
Huh.
And, you know, it's probably obviated now. I live in a neighborhood in which there was a principle when it started that you can't grow trees through somebody else's view. Of course, everybody did, you know, and so people have lost what was most precious about having a house in this neighborhood. So it's like, that's just another lesson I'm deriving is how a core principle, not imposed, not like my, you know, my values, you know, like, you know, God, you know, one principle could be that, you know, God is in the center of everything. Well, there's going to be a lot of people who don't believe that. But if you can find that thing about if you build a building, you have to replace the nature that the building got rid of. That sort of like jumps to the top of the decision tree. It just sits there. And so underneath that, you have to make different decisions. The other thing, and I know we're sort of, we're cranking along here, and if you have to leave, you can just tell me, but
I don't.
I in the story that you told, and I may bollocks her name, Susan Simard, is that how you say it?
Simard, yeah.
You told a story of research, a massive research project they were doing about the forest. And the results of that project were not going to be within her lifetime.
Right. Yeah.
And I think there's something in there also in these stories that, and it doesn't have to be politicians, it doesn't have to be, you know, corporations, it doesn't have to be any particular entity. It could be individuals or, you know, like the knitting club. But that idea that the effects of what I'm doing, I know this is the seventh generation principle, but it's not, that's even hard for human, you know, at least Americans to think about. You know, they can barely think about the next generation. They don't want to pay their property taxes to support the schools because I don't have kids. You know, I mean, we just narrow-minded. But that sense, and that's the way an ecosystem thinks, if it, you know, reflects on itself, is that this is for the long haul. This is not a short-term answer. So, you know, are there stories that you collected around the impact of sort of intergenerational awareness, gratitude for the sidewalks that our ancestors put in, whether or not we like concrete, and, you know, and thoughtfulness about initiating things that you may not see in your lifetime, and you may not have the satisfaction of knowing that, you know, your fingerprint is on it. So any of the stories that you recall?
Well, I mean, I think that every, you know, every action that any of the people that I wrote about is going to, you know, create waves going forward. I mean, I think about the research in the chapter about agriculture. You know, they're doing this paint. I mean, I think some of us I'm always blown away by how much research it takes, how much work it takes to understand what's going on in nature. You know, there will be some scientist that is looking at, you know, studying very closely how bees are going into flowers, looking at, you know, are they going in through the top? Are they chewing a hole in the side of the blossom? I mean, that is just painstaking work. So there's that, all that science going on out in the heartland by Jonathan Lundgren and his students and colleagues as to, you know, how we raise our crops. Are we raising, you know, what's the difference between growing corn when it's corn in a monoculture with rows and a bare area between it, you know, this bare ground between it. What's the difference between that and these cornfields where, you know, they're raising, they have corn growing in the midst of dozens of other kinds of plants, you know, so that it looks kind of like a jungle, not like what we think of as a cornfield. I mean, that that kind of painstaking research is going to make waves around the world in very slow way, you know, in very slow ways and, you know, one hopes in faster ways. But I, you know, I think all that kind of work is really taking the future into its embrace.
Mm. So you just bring up something for me, is the question of the pace of change, you know, and it feels like we're right now running to outrun the consequences of the industrial growth society. Whereas the processes that are required for the healing and the preservation are slower because they're relationships between human and building networks and, you know, science, that accurate science. But somehow or another, all of this needs to like get out ahead of the train that's barreling forward. Do you have stories about how communities of some sort, you know, have accelerated the pace of their work while retaining the relational nature of it?
I'm not sure I can really address that. But, you know, I honestly have to say that one of the things that struck me was how the pace of change in a natural environment can be pretty rapid. You know, a lot of times we just need to stop doing the damage that we are inflicting on that landscape. So that was the case. That was the case when the culvert was removed and then the salmon and the lamprey could go back upstream, you know, that area upstream returned to, you know, an ecological balance much faster than anybody thought. Or that when the ranchers changed their grazing, I mean, there were things that they couldn't have anticipated. You know, they couldn't have anticipated what kind of seeds were still in the soil and were going to sprout and start to grow, create this corridor along the creeks. And they couldn't anticipate that the beaver were going to move in and change the landscape the way that they did. You know, these were just things that the humans, you know, the humans recognized what their damage was, but then it was kind of trusting in the rest of nature to know that the healing was going to start in some fashion.
That is so beautiful. We just have to stop. I mean, really, you know, we just have to stop hitting ourselves over the head.
Right.
And then we'll feel a great deal of relief.
Right. There are two really great beaver stories in my book. And I loved the one that was at the end in the chapter about cities. And it took, you know, it's a story from here in Portland where the engineers in the city of Gresham, which is just outside of Portland, they took the really progressive, enlightened step of treating wastewater from this industrial area not by running it through a building with lots of pipes and chemicals, but by creating an artificial wetlands and having that wastewater go through this system that kind of looks like an intestine, you know, but
right,
full of grasses and plants and all that, and having nature remove the impurities from the water before it dumped into the slough. And one day the young biologist who was sort of in charge of keeping the system, you know, staying on top of the system and making sure it was working the way it should, you know, she was told, oh no, something's wrong with the artificial wetlands. You know, it's not working right. And so she went out there, and anyway, she discovered that there was a family of beavers that had moved into this artificial wetland and had dammed up part of it. And because they had created what was just the perfect scenario for beavers, you know, it's water and willows and other plants. Anyway, so there was this long struggle where, you know, the engineers who created this artificial wetland thought, you know, we got to get rid of the beavers. And so they would get rid of the beavers, move them out, and then another family of beavers would move in because it was a perfect place. And then this young biologist said, well, let's just see who does a better job, the beavers or the design that we came up with. And so they tested the water that was going into the slough after, can't remember how many different storms, six or seven or eight different storms, one with the beavers' work intact and one with the engineers' work intact. And of course, it turned out that the beavers' situation was the one that cleaned up the water. You know, it cleaned up because not only was the water laden with impurities going past all these plants, but it was going through these dirt dams, dirt and, you know, grass dams. And I just, it was just so wonderful. It's just such a wonderful lesson of how, my God, there's all these answers out there that we don't know are there and that we're not necessarily ready for, but we should sure keep our eyes open for them. I just have to let my dog out.
Yeah, I know. We're lucky that my cat didn't jump up.
I thought that old dog would sleep through the whole thing, but no.
Yeah. I just love this. And as I listen to you, I think, boy, you know, there's so many young people who are so frustrated with, you know, what they're inheriting. I mean, the weight of it is tremendous. And so what they find to do, you know, there's a branch that goes into protest. But do you find that there are young people flooding into ecology, biology, you know?
Yeah, there are young
into to make a difference.
There are young people going into the science. There are a lot of young people going into agriculture, you know, because they see the opportunity to grow healthier food than what's available to most people in the stores. They see the ability to heal landscapes, you know, make landscapes more diverse and more ecologically rich than conventional farming does. And, you know, I think that there's, you know, there's been such an emphasis on it for decades that, you know, smart people go into working with their head, you know, they're just, you know, they should go and be a doctor or a lawyer or a writer or whatever. But there are a lot of people who want to do both. They want to work with their hands and they want to work with their heads and they want to work on the landscape. And so, yeah, I just see so many. It's super exciting to me. I'll go to conferences. Like there's a group, and I think they're headquartered in Washington, although their conferences are back and forth, but the Organic Seed Alliance, and I wrote mm-hmm. about that in the book. And I love going to those conferences because, you know, the when the media reports about farming, they talk about, you know, the graying of farming, you know, that all the farmers right. are getting old and who's going to do it. There are just so many young people there and they're dying to have their own farms. And a lot of them are renting land to do farming. A lot of them are not only farming to grow food, but they're farming to grow seeds. You know, they're developing all these new varieties of plants that are more resilient in the face of heat. So they're, you know, they're just doing brilliant work. So I find that super exciting.
Exactly. So if you come north, I invite you to come to Whidbey Island where I live, because exactly what you're talking about is happening here.
Right.
You know, we're restoring the prairie with camas, and then we have an organic farm school, and we have a growing number. I think, I don't know how many, but, you know, growing number of farmers, and we've developed a food hub so that farmers can sell through a, you know, system. We're developing like a food system. You know, it's so exciting to be amongst this growing, honorable profession of farming. And half the farmers are musicians. So, you know, then we, you know, we party on Friday nights.
Right.
And it's just, it's the most wholesome thing to live
really
amongst this.
I remember years ago, my father-in-law, who, you know, he hadn't come from a farming background, but he had come from a very, very poor background. And he was talking about some negotiation with a more powerful, wealthier person that he was in, and he didn't like the terms that this more powerful person was offering him. And he said, "Well, what does he think I am, a farmer?" And I think it reflected the view of people who were growing up in the early 20th century, you know, that they were getting off the farms and they were really going to use their brains and they were going to, and I love it that is changing so much, you know, and that you go to the farmer's market or you go to these conferences and you see all these really bright, excited, younger people. And also so many people of color reclaiming their heritage in agriculture. It's really fabulous.
Yeah. So I think we're getting close to, ending here. I could stay with you forever, but maybe not our audience. So yeah, is there a windup? Is there something that occurs to you to say at this point, given all of our conversation, something that's missing that you want to be sure people know, or just anything that
well,
you want to say?
I just think it's so, you know, what I'm looking at, I guess not all over the book, but in part, that what drew me into the book was looking at mutualisms, you know, mutually beneficial relationships among living things, kind of like bees and flowers and trees in the forest and mycorrhizal fungi underneath the ground. And it turns out that, you know, that used to be the kind of like oddball crackpot science or subject of science years ago, you know, 40 years ago or whatever. Now the people who started in those careers are sort of at the forefront of all the exciting science going on. But I think that, you know, and scientists won't say that every living thing has a mutually beneficial relationship with other living things, because they haven't actually studied every single living thing. But I think that we can assume that that's the case, that every living thing has these beneficial connections to 1, 2, 50. You know, I just saw a sign when I was hiking someplace about a certain kind of pine tree. And in this forest, they were really on top of the science, because it said that pine tree has mutually beneficial relationships with 50 other species in the forest. And I think that's, you know, that's probably just a tiny fraction of what we know. So I think that we have to understand that really the natural world of which we are part is held together by these cooperative relationships, that the natural world is sculpted and evolves with these cooperative relationships. And if that is the case for all the rest of nature, surely it is also the case for us. And I think that if we can take that to heart, that we can figure out a lot of our difficulties if we can take that to heart, you know, that message of cooperation and connection. We need to hold on to that.
Right. Create the conditions in which we behave like we're part of an ecosystem. And part of it, really, Kristen, is storytelling.
Right.
You know, a big part of it is storytelling. It's not manipulation to select one story over another. The media is often manipulative. It's just when something brilliant has happened in these small incremental steps of healing relationships or the natural world, to tell the story multiplies it. So I really thank you for your storytelling in The Soil Will Save Us, which totally influenced my last book, Blessing the Hands That Feed Us. And then, you know, your storytelling in this. And, you know, I think we're all eager to see what stories you're going to collect in a while. Well, so
great talking to you, Vicki, and I admire all of your work so much.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review so that this hopeful message can get out to more people. Check out Post Carbon Institute's resilience website for show notes and for more guest information. Thanks also to Asher Miller, Amy Buringrud, and Clara Winter of Post Carbon Institute, plus production assistant Michelle Wigg from frugalityandfreedom.com.